Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, if you listen to American Variety regularly, you might have noticed that we have a fair number of shows about pioneering women. Women who are brilliant or brave or take big risks or sometimes all those things. People like Amelia Earhart or CIA agent June Cobb or iconoclastic paleontologist Jingmei O'Connor or Civil War spy Sarah Emma Edmonds or the first female zoo director or world-class storyteller Victoria Burnett. I mean, the stories go on, right, out of hundreds of shows on American Variety over these years. But our purpose in doing that isn't just to strike some kind of gender balance. It's because, for the most part, these women achieve at a high level, but their achievements go largely unrecognized. Amelia Earhart is an exception, of course, but she was very good at self-promotion and was, in fact, married to a promoter, so it was kind of natural. And, of course, the manner of her death made her a legend. So really, my interest in these women is that they have interesting stories that are little known. And if there's anything we like on American Variety, it's those kinds of stories. Today's show is certainly one of those things. It's the story of Elizabeth Smith Friedman, a pioneering cryptoanalyst, or codebreaker, whose work over decades in decoding messages for the U.S. government would send infamous gangsters to prison and bring down an extensive and nearly invisible Nazi spy ring in World War II. And she's definitely someone who did her groundbreaking work in the shadow of her better-known husband, a legendary cryptologist named William Friedman. Together, they developed methods that led to the creation of the science of cryptology and laid the foundation for modern code breaking. So a film about her life, The Code Breaker, will premiere on Monday, January 11th at 9 p.m. Eastern on PBS's program American Experience. And here with us to talk about it is Hillary Klotz-Steinman, one of the producers of the film. Welcome, Hillary.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for being here on with us. First, why don't you just give us a brief outline of Elizabeth Smith Friedman's background. When and where was she born, and how did she come to get involved in this, obviously, arcane field at that time?
Well, Elizabeth had a very unlikely start for a codebreaker who was incredibly influential in two world wars. She came from a rural background. She grew up in small town Huntington, Indiana. She was the 10th child in a farming family, and expectations for her in life were very low. She was expected to just basically grow up, get married, have children, and live on a farm, you know. But Elizabeth had seen her mother give birth to 10 children and spend her entire life devoted to child rearing. And she wanted something different for herself. She was bookish. And her mother actually, unexpectedly, had gotten some education. So she had these two examples in her mother of someone who both could never fulfill her potential, but knew something of education. So Elizabeth wanted something different in her life. After she graduated from high school, she begged her family to let her go to college, and her father was absolutely vehemently opposed, but she convinced him to allow her to go. He wouldn't pay for it, but he gave her a loan with interest, something like 4 or 6% interest, and she was able to go to college. And in college, she just discovered this love of English and Greek literature, and she graduated from college, and she did what all women were expected to do. She was expected to just go teach at a school. So she taught at a rural school, and she was bored to death. She quit after a year, and everyone expects her to come home and get married and live on the farm like the rest of her family. But what does she do? She goes to Chicago, the big city, where she knows no one. She has a little bit of money, and she starts looking for a job. And she's a complete and total failure. She tells employment agencies that she wants something in research. Well, there's nothing. So on her last day, she's about to go home, but she stops at the Newberry Library because there's this rare edition of Shakespeare's first folio. It's the first printed collection of Shakespeare's plays. And she goes to look at it. And while she's there, a librarian sees her just standing there endlessly looking at this thing and tells her she knows of this industrialist, this rich industrialist who's looking for a researcher for a project related to Shakespeare. She calls the industrialist. The guy marches over immediately. He's in Chicago to see Elizabeth and says, "I've got a job. I need you to come out to my estate at once." And Elizabeth, who is nothing but a risk taker, she's gotten off the farm. She's gotten herself to Chicago. You know, she's gotten an education, says she goes with him, this man she's never met, to this estate outside of Chicago in Geneva, Illinois, to work on Shakespeare.
So here's a total stranger. What year was this happening, Hillary?
So Elizabeth is born in 1892. Can you imagine? This is before women have the right to vote. Very few women get an education. She graduates from college in 1915 and goes to Chicago in 1916. So at this point, it's very unseemly for a young woman to even be traveling alone with a strange man. But she goes out to his estate, and while she's there, he says, I've got this project. I believe that Shakespeare did not write Shakespeare, that Francis Bacon wrote Shakespeare. And this was not quackery. A lot of important people of the day, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Mark Twain, thought this was true. And what they believed was that Bacon had created the cipher called the Bacon Cipher, which was a real thing, which was the way to encode things, that he'd written using his own cipher the secret message in Shakespeare saying that he was the true author. And it was going to be Elizabeth's job to look closely at Shakespeare's texts to find the secret messages and decode them and prove this once and for all. And Elizabeth, who never wanted an ordinary life, thought, oh my gosh, this is my chance to make literary history. So, like, within moments, she agrees to go to Geneva, Illinois, and to take a job with this eccentric millionaire on this basically bucolic estate in the middle of nowhere. And that's how she gets her first introduction to code breaking. So it's a very unlikely start for a woman who would go on to become a code breaker who smashes military codes in two world wars and fights the mob. It all starts with a literary mystery, a literary cipher.
That's why I asked what year it was, because, at that time, I mean, even now, most people would be very reluctant to jump up and go off out of town to stay overnight at the home of a guy they just met 30 seconds ago. And, and here's this older man. So, but back at that time, it was extremely daring. And it was kind of a reflection of her personality in general. Plus the fact that she was about to leave town because she was a failure and was going to go back to being under dad's thumb and be a nice little girl. And here suddenly was an opportunity to do what she'd come to town to do. So that was kind of natural.
In these very formative years of her life, there were so many moments where she could have just sort of followed what was expected of her, whether it was the fight to go to college, whether it was, you know, come home and get married. She got a job. Whether it was, you know, she didn't want to stay in a job she hated, so she took a risk and went to Chicago. And then when she was a complete failure, she was able in the moment, because of her passion for Shakespeare and literature, because instead of choosing to go on a sightseeing trip on the lake or around town, she went to a library to see this piece of literary history. It changed the entire course of her life, and she was not afraid to take a risk.
She was lucky, or she had a good guardian angel of some kind. So Elizabeth, who I gather had never worked on secret codes before, found herself working on the Shakespearean authorship theory that Sir Francis Bacon had actually written Shakespeare, and that mystery question still exists today in some circles. I mean, there's fairly serious people who still kind of believe that. But what did she end up finding?
Well, what happens is Elizabeth masters the skill very quickly. And what she realizes is that as she's looking, her job, the Bacon cipher is a way that you can encode anything with two different kinds of letters, two different kinds, like the same with computer technology. It's all based on zeros and ones. Bacon's cipher was said there's two forms in anything, and you can encode anything in the English language if you break it up into A's and B's, or apples and oranges, or black and white stones. You can create a message right there. And so in Shakespeare, they believed that this message was created with two fonts. Imagine, if you would, Times New Roman versus Arial. And you could read that message. And she finds very quickly that there's no such message. But it's terrifying. How does she tell her boss? How does she tell this eccentric millionaire that this is all bunk? Because what happens is, you know, it's basically they saw what they wanted to see. They made the end, they made the final message work. But really, it's just that there were very funky differences in early printing that created differences in font. But there was nothing there. But what she gets is this love of code and cipher. She starts looking at Fabian's library, this eccentric millionaire who's got this library of all of the previous, you know, codes and ciphers, the work that's been done over hundreds and thousands of years in Europe, you know, going back to Caesar and other people. So she starts learning the history of cipher. And she also learns, you know, about scientific method, that something's got to be repeatable. It's got to be codifiable. It's got to be teachable. Like any good science experiment, someone doesn't know the answer has to be able to get the same answer. even though this first job is complete bunk, it sets her on the course of this pursuit of knowledge, this pursuit of truth. And Bacon's credo was knowledge is power. And that's really the guiding force in her entire life, is this search for knowledge and the power of knowledge.
Interesting. Well, along the lines of being in the right place at the right time, along the way there at Riverbank, a love story appeared. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, while Elizabeth is working for this eccentric millionaire on this Bacon cipher, she's getting incredibly depressed because she sees that it's all bunk. But there's something that's making her very happy, which is there's a young geneticist who's also working at this basically think tank that this eccentric millionaire has created. And he's a geneticist, but he's also been asked, because he's good with a camera, to make enlargements of Shakespeare's folio so that Elizabeth can look really closely at these differences of font. So they start working closely together, and he's this very well-dressed, very smart young man, educated at Cornell, but he's entirely different from her. He is a Jewish Russian immigrant. His family came to America to escape the pogroms. They couldn't be more different, but they are drawn together by this pursuit of knowledge, and she teaches him code breaking. And very quickly, he too feels like this is all bunk. This is not true. This theory is false. And they don't want to work on it anymore. But what they do work on is their relationship. They fall in love on this estate where in their free time, there's a swimming pool. They go on bike rides. There's this, at their disposal is this great sports car, a Stutz Bearcat, which is the, you know, the funnest sports car of the day. And they go for rides. And, you know, this millionaire has this Japanese garden and they have romantic picnics. And he's a photographer and he's constantly taking pictures of her. And they fall in love. And theirs is a union that's not meant to be. They're from different religions and different parts of the country. And, you know, he's urban, she's rural. But it's a meeting of the minds. He is fascinated by her brilliance. She's fascinated by him. And they fall in love. And they're drawn together by this thing that binds them together, which is that they know that the theory of Bacon writing Shakespeare is false. And what are they going to do about it? And against the odds, they take off and they elope and they get married and they have to decide, okay, what are we going to do with the rest of our lives now?
Interesting. So they had a honeymoon ahead of the marriage. They had a wonderful honeymoon for free in a great place. That's part of a pretty cool story. And I've seen photographs of them and some of the promos for the American Experience broadcast. And they look, you know, you could see they're in love. You could just see it in these old black and white photos from, you know, 100 years ago, and they're very bright and they look modern. I mean, somehow they just look like modern people from, you know, if you put them in different clothes, they'd be yesterday. So you can see they're in the right place there. You're listening to American Variety. We're in the right place, talking with Hilary Klotz Steinman about a woman who was one of the first code breakers and really invented, in part along with her now husband, the science of cryptology. And it's really keyed to a PBS broadcast that's coming up called The Code Breaker. It'll premiere on Monday, January 11th at 9 p.m. on PBS's American Experience. We're talking again with Hilary Klotz Steinman. So, Hilary, I think then after they snuck away from this wonderful estate where they'd been working on this bogus project, they ended up putting their code-breaking skills to work first in World War I. So we're talking still about the early part of the 20th century. How did that come about and what did they do?
Well, you've got Elizabeth and William, and there's really this very special marriage of equals where they share this love of code breaking. They've got this intellectual curiosity. They're searching for the truth, but they don't know what to do with their lives, and they want to leave Riverbank, but they don't know where to go. And then World War I breaks out, and this eccentric millionaire, who's an opportunist, volunteers their skills for the U.S. government to break codes for the U.S. military. Because at this point, you've got to remember that prior to World War I, intelligence is seen as something a bit shady. We don't spy on our friends, our allies, and we only spy on our enemies during wartime. And so there's no FBI, there's no CIA, there's no NSA, there's no intelligence apparatus. So the U.S. is entering World War I with absolutely... there's a handful of people in the entire country that know anything at all about codes and ciphers. And two of them are Elizabeth and William. And so this eccentric millionaire, George Fabian, volunteers their services to the U.S. military to break codes. They don't know anything about military codes, but they read up in this Fabian's library. and they teach themselves everything they need to know about military codes, and they start breaking messages for the U.S. military, for the Navy, for the Army, for the Justice Department, for the State Department, for the War Department. And they're learning as they go. It's about as deep on-the-job training as you can get, day after day, working side by side as a team, cracking messages, providing intelligence to the U.S. military. And soon the U.S. military figures out, okay, they need to have an in-house operation. They need to have it in D.C. They need to shift it away from this estate in Chicago, outside of Chicago. And they form their own bureau in D.C. But then Fabian, ever the opportunist, says, well, you know what? You still need me. You still need my experts. You need to train more intelligence officers. And he convinces the Army to send a group of officers for code-breaking training to Riverbank, the estate. And Elizabeth and William train the first group of codebreakers ever for the U.S. military. And they don't know anything about training codebreakers. They've just learned this stuff themselves. But what they do is they take everything they've learned, they stay one step ahead of the people they're training, and they teach them systematically how to do it. Not just best practices like working in teams, documenting your work, but every single method that they've learned. They go through all the existing methods, and then they're cracking so many messages that they start developing new methods. They push the boundaries of what is known, and they make it all documented and replicable. And so they teach the first generation of dedicated military codebreakers in U.S. history. And they're astonishingly successful.
Wow, amazing. They really were just the two of them single-handedly or double-handedly inventing a field there. It's pretty amazing. So I know that, especially for Elizabeth, the next challenge came during Prohibition when she went to work for the feds and became a gangbuster. So tell us about that story.
Well, what happens to Elizabeth next is very unexpected, because they moved to D.C. after World War I, and William Starr, her husband, is rising. He's working for the U.S. Army. He's a chief codebreaker, chief cryptologist, and she works for a bit of time, but then she goes home. She's expected to, you know, she has children, and women were not expected to work once they had children. But one day in 1925, the Coast Guard comes knocking on her door. They need her help. They're still unbelievably very few codebreakers in America of her quality. And even though she's a woman, they're desperate. They have to turn to her. This is Prohibition, and she's no teetotaler, but she comes to the service of the U.S. Coast Guard because the Coast Guard has been tasked with protecting the entire U.S. coastline from smugglers who are bringing in booze from abroad. And they've got all these piles and piles of secret messages that they've collected. The Coast Guard has radio towers, and they've collected secret messages from these smugglers, but they can't read them. They've got 2 years worth of undecrypted messages. And so she is the first stay-at-home working mom, and she tells them, I can do this, but I've got to work from home because I've got kids to care for. And they're desperate for expertise. And in 3 months, she cracks 2 years worth of secret messages between the smugglers. And she starts to allow the Coast Guard to get a grip on all of this illegal liquor that's coming into America. And what we need to remember is that, you know, sometimes we think about these, you know, sort of glamorous bootleggers with this bathtub gin and, you know, the roaring 20s. But actually, this was very violent gangster business. People are getting gunned down in the streets. This is dangerous stuff. And so she's helping the U.S. government to, you know, crack down on these violent gangsters. And what she does, which is really groundbreaking, is she says, you know, you're playing a cat and mouse game. These gangsters, they have so many more ships, so many more resources. They have these very sophisticated codes. They're running circles around you. Liquor's coming in day and night, and your tiny fleet of ships cannot stop them all. You cannot patrol every inch of the coastline. You've got to stay ahead of them. You've got to crack their codes. I can do this, but if you let me build a code-breaking team with more code-breakers, we can stay ahead of the game. We can read their minds. We can know what they're doing before they do it, and then you can arrest them. And so she gets to create her own code-breaking unit, train junior code-breakers, and she becomes the first chief cryptologist of the Coast Guard, and she develops this team, and they break the back of some of the biggest smugglers in the country, and she changes the tide of Prohibition. And it's quite remarkable. And she does it by pioneering basically something that we now know is called all-source intelligence. She doesn't just decrypt messages and pass them along. She actually creates actionable intelligence. She weaponizes the data. So she's looking at these messages and she's figuring out, okay, this captain on this ship, they're going to this port. She knows the names of every captain of every ship in every port, where they're leaving, where they're going to, you know, who's delivering the money from where and when and who they're meeting up with and, you know, who's back at headquarters in Vancouver or who's in South America. And she puts together the whole story so that when she gets a message, which just has, it seems like an innocuous message that from one person to another, even when decrypted, she can put it as a piece of the puzzle. She's got this whole map of their networks so that the government, the prohibition agents, can move in and make arrests and break up the gang. So it's nothing short of revolutionary. You know, after 9/11, when all the government agencies got together and created these fusion centers to fight terrorists, people thought that that was a new model. But that's what Elizabeth created back in the 1930s to fight organized crime.
Well, I can tell you that, you know, organized crime obviously isn't real tolerant of interference, especially in the 1930s. Was she, I assume she was a target at some point?
Elizabeth was a target. She had plainclothes policemen following her because she was set to testify in one of the biggest cases. And she was in charge of bringing the arrests of a lot of the major players in Al Capone's gang. She totally disrupted their business. And when she went to testify in the trial, there was a fear that the second the lawyers for the mob identified her, they'd put a hit out on her. So Elizabeth's husband, William, often talked about where when the kids asked, where's mom? He said, oh, she's being taken out for a ride. And it was a joke, but it wasn't really, because there was a very big threat for testifying. But she did it because she thought it was her responsibility and she wanted to fight organized crime.
So what you described that she did there was, you know, I guess it's broadening her analytical skills beyond just code breaking to understanding the way that a criminal enterprise and really by extension, any intelligence network operates. So I think you could say that she pioneered the development of strategic intelligence. Now, this was a time before the CIA, as you said at the beginning, there were no such organizations in the American government or anywhere in the world, really. And I have a feeling her work was important in the development of the Office of Strategic Services, or the OSS, in World War II, which was the forerunner of the CIA. Just briefly, is that a pretty valid statement?
You know, Elizabeth was in demand in every agency of the country because she was not only a master code breaker, she was a master code maker. And when the OSS was getting started, when it was a fledgling spy agency, they didn't know how to create secure communications. And so she's the one that created the secure code so that they could send messages amongst each other and get their work done. And they also didn't know how to break codes, so they couldn't read the messages of the enemy, of the Nazis. And so she's the one who taught them how to crack codes and also cracked many of the codes for them. So she didn't just work for the Coast Guard and the Bureau of Prohibition. She worked for all different aspects of the government. And the spies wouldn't have been successful without her, her training, her expertise, her experience.
Yeah, I think key to what she was doing, and she probably discovered this during World War II in that work or maybe leading up to it, but that she had a real talent for decoding ciphers and in particular recognizing patterns. I mean, do we know what that was actually like? Did she do mathematical calculations in her head or cut out pieces and move them around? Or did she work at it? Or did the coding just kind of jump out at her in an effortless way? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, do you think that it was a specialized kind of genius? Like, you know, Mozart wrote symphonies like he was just taking dictation? Or was it like that for her, do you think?
Elizabeth's genius, like much genius, is 90% perspiration and 10% inspiration. Here was a woman who day after day for decades cracked codes. So by the time you get to World War II, when she's asked to work for the U.S. Navy fighting Nazi spies in South America, she has been cracking codes for decades and she's seen every kind of code in the book. And she's cracked hundreds of thousands of codes. So she knows what kind of code machine might have been used to make a code. She knows every method in the book. She knows the mind. She knows, because she's such a pioneer in strategic intelligence, she knows to look at the mind of the person creating that message, of the spy. Mm. What are their weaknesses? What is their background? She finds the chinks in the armor. She finds the way in. But also, she's a pioneer in methods to crack codes. And so she knows how to analyze messages, and then she knows how to weaponize the data. So a lot of times in recent years, when people talk about Elizabeth and finally give her some of the recognition that's due, they talk about her intuition, but I almost find it dismissive and patronizing, as if it's a whiff of sexism about women's intuition. It's the fact that she had the knowledge and the experience from decades of hard work. and decades of making innovations in code breaking to allow her to find and crack the hardest cipher machines out there. Because she could take all that knowledge and wisdom and experience and apply it to the hardest problems of the day. That's what made her a genius. And the fact that she never, ever gave up. There was no message that she considered uncrackable. No machine that was unbreakable. She could reverse wire something. She reverse engineer something with her team. She was fearless.
Yeah, so she was a kind of a genius. It kind of reminds me of the way a chess master works. You know, here's the question then, really we're getting to the end of the show, but with all she accomplished, why isn't she better known? I mean, there are other code breakers like Alan Turing in England and the Navajo code talkers. They were well known really right after the war, after World War II. So why not Elizabeth, just briefly?
Elizabeth's story was buried for decades, more than half a century, because of sexism and secrecy. She was forced by the U.S. Navy at the end of World War II to take an oath of secrecy that she would never, ever talk about her work fighting Nazi spies in World War II. And as a result, the entire history of her career was buried. So after World War II, when, you know, military men are getting medals and promotions and recognition and climbing the ranks, she's basically laid off and told to, you know, go home and thanks for your service and goodbye. And then J. Edgar Hoover takes credit for all of her groundbreaking work fighting Nazi spies in South America and eliminating the threat of Nazis in the Western Hemisphere and, you know, winning the Battle of Atlantic. Hoover takes credit for all of it. He puts FBI labels on all of her teams, her Coast Guard and Navy teams' decrypts, and takes full credit for her work. And it's really only in recent years, because of the Freedom of Information Act and things like that, and intrepid journalists who have uncovered her story, that her story has come to light. But as Elizabeth herself put it, you know, she was forced into a dome of silence from which she could never emerge. And the records of her expertise were buried in the National Archives for decades.
Well, I'm glad we're unburying them a little bit here, and that there have been a book written about her, and she's beginning to kind of come out of the shadows. Hillary, we're going to have to leave it there. It's been a fascinating story, but we're at the end of our time. Again, a film about Elizabeth Friedman's life, The Codebreaker, will premiere on Monday, January 11th. At 9 p.m. Eastern on PBS's program American Experience. And I think you can Google it, just American Experience Codebreaker, and it will come up. And Hillary's told me that there are a lot of ancillary goodies on there too, trailers and different background pieces that you can learn more about this story. You can also read more in the book on which the film is based, which is entitled The Woman Who Smashed Codes, A True Story of Love, Spies, and the Unlikely Heroine Who Outwitted America's Enemies. It could be a world record length of title there. And the author is Jason Fagone, F-A-G-O-N-E, so you can Google that. And you can see more of the documentary films that my guest Hillary Klotz Steinman has produced at her website, eponymously named HillaryKlotzSteinman.com. So I'm going to spell that, H-I-L-A-R-Y, is one L, and then Klotz is K-L-O-T-Z, and then Steinman, you could probably spell for yourself, S-T-E-I-N-M-A-N.com. Hillary, I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I love being part of your show. And thank you so much for bringing Elizabeth Smith Friedman's story to your audience. She's an inspiring woman who, you know, was influential in two world wars and fought organized crime. And I'm so glad that we're able to share her story in our film for American Experience, The Codebreaker, and that you're sharing her story.
Well, I'm glad too. And she more than deserves it. So thanks to all of you out there for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.